It is Friday, May the 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, the Iran nuclear deal. Palestinian leader hoping for a two-nation solution.
It's out of anger, frustration, and lack of ability to address and influence events around in that area.
Also in the news, President Trump and his lawyers.
When you hire a lawyer, never want to hire someone who wants to be as famous as you are and has as big an ego as you do.
Also ahead, World Press Freedom Day, plus some sounds from the world of music. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says Iran will not renegotiate a 2015 nuclear agreement with world powers. The statement was made days before President Trump's deadline to decide if the U.S. will remain in that agreement.
In the last year or so, we've been told that President Trump is unhappy with the deal. And it now appears that the response from some Europeans has been to offer the United States more concessions from our pocket. This appeasement entails promises of a new deal that would include matters we all decided to exclude at the outset of our negotiations.
President Trump has said he will pull out of the pact if amendments are not made, including a proposal to limit Iran's ballistic missile program, which Iran has maintained is a defensive deterrent. Meantime, a foreign policy advisor to Iran's supreme leader has warned that Iran would withdraw from the deal if Mr. Trump follows through on his threat to pull out of the accord. There was no immediate response to the comments from the Trump administration. The three European countries that signed the agreement, Britain, France, and Germany, have repeatedly tried to persuade President Trump not to withdraw. China and Russia also signed the deal, and as signatories, the countries are members of the United Nations Security Council. In remarks to a meeting of the Palestine Liberation Organization's legislative body this week, President Mahmoud Abbas created a furor over remarks suggesting the Jews of Europe brought persecution and the Holocaust upon themselves because of their social function as bankers and moneylenders. The UN coordinator for the Middle East, Nikolai Mladenov, called the statements unacceptable, disturbing, he said, not to serve the cause of peace. Emmanuel Nachshon is the Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman.
Israel is deeply shocked by the anti-Semitic speech of the Palestinian president, Mr. Abbas. What we have heard from Mr. Abbas is a series of anti-Semitic accusations of an ugly nature. Mr. Abbas accuses actually the Jewish people for being responsible for its own tragedy. Those are things that we cannot accept. There is also in Mr. Abbas's speech an element of Holocaust denial, which is also punishable by law in many countries of the world.
And White House Mideast envoy Jason Greenblatt called the remarks unfortunate, distressing, and disheartening. Similar reactions came from the German government and from the European Union. The comments overshadowed a Palestinian meeting dedicated to unity, democracy, and the settling of strategy and came just days before the U.S. Embassy in Israel opens its doors in Jerusalem as Israeli marks the country's 70th anniversary. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal, speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty, says the Palestinian leader in office since 2005 is frustrated with the lack of progress on peace.
Sees that any hopes that he had of a peaceful creation of two nations is not in sight anymore. And it's out of anger, frustration, and lack of ability to address and influence events around in that area. Very unfortunate, very effectively a wrong thing to do, because when you tend to deny history, you end up creating an alternative narrative, and that's the alternative narrative that doesn't go anywhere. What he should have done, and I think he probably will have to get back to doing it, is to create a coalition that will help him to proceed towards the two-nation theory and its implementation. That at this moment looks very remote. And it's out of that remoteness and the failure of his own leadership that he has got to this stage. What we do need to think about and we do need to stress on is that the fact that the two-nation theory has been derailed, because that strategy doesn't exist, no alternative has taken place in its place, and therefore, under the circumstances, a lot of these kinds of irresponsible statements are going to come out. What he's going to do, as far as I can guess, is that he's going to, quote-unquote, start the process of radicalizing the movement once again, and that will be destructive.
Well, at 82 years of age, is his leadership position threatened now?
The reason why he's doing it is because he knows that the new leadership that is going to come out after he's gone is going to be highly radicalized. Remember what's happening right now in Gaza. The reality is that that is now going to be the quote-unquote platform for the future. The younger people in Palestine, both in Gaza as well as in the Ramallah, are essentially radicalizing. And as they're radicalizing, things are going to get worse. Abbas is basically on his way out. But before he goes out, he's going to endorse this radicalized view, and that whosoever comes in his place will need to contend with it. And it's not going to be easy without very concerted support from outside the region.
Samir Iqbal went on to say the only solution is for the Palestinian leadership to return to the so-called middle ground, where the issues, demands, and concerns of both sides can be addressed. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump and his lawyers are changing explanations about the $130,000 hush money payment his personal attorney made to porn star Stormy Daniels days before the 2016 election to keep quiet about an alleged affair with Mr. Trump. After denying any knowledge of the payment, President Trump is now saying he was aware of the payment. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reporting now from the White House.
Rudy Giuliani told Fox News Channel's Hannity the president reimbursed Michael Cohen with money funneled through Cohen's law firm.
It's not campaign money.
Legal analyst Jonathan Turley says the White House is trying to shift the narrative.
The clear effort here is to create a legal defense for the president, even at the cost of more political damage.
It all seems to contradict what the president himself said on Air Force One last month.
Did you know about the $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels?
Nor about where Cohen got the money.
These guys are making it up as they go along.
Daniels' lawyer, Michael Avenatti, on CBS This Morning.
I hope they keep talking and I hope they keep tweeting because our case just keeps getting better.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
Alan Lichtman is an American University scholar here in Washington. He spoke with my colleague Sarah Williams about the payment to Stormy Daniels.
You know, when you hire a lawyer, you never want to hire someone who wants to be as famous as you are and has as big an ego as you do. Mr. Giuliani is not controllable. He has his own agenda. He has his own interests. And that's not what you want in your attorney. And he's caused untold new troubles for President Trump. Mr. Giuliani directly contradicted what Trump had earlier said that he knew nothing about the payment with Stormy Daniels. And while no quote-unquote campaign funds were involved, in fact, there is a very strong case to be made that this $130,000 was a campaign contribution because it was designed to protect the candidate from potentially embarrassing revelations that could have hurt his reelection, and as such had to be reported to the Federal Election Commission. And we're not just talking about a technical violation. We're talking about a felony.
And Mr. Giuliani kind of almost got into that a bit, saying during this interview last night, well, if this had come out and this happened right before the election, the results of the election could have been very different.
Obviously, we can't say it would have turned the election, but clearly it would have been very damaging to the president to have this affair come out right before the election at a time when he was already somewhat reeling from the revelations in the Access Hollywood tape and was very vulnerable on this issue of his relationships with women. So clearly this payoff was directly related to the Trump campaign, given the timing and given the issue involved. And if so, it had to have been reported. If it came from Trump, if it came from someone else like Mr. Cohen, then it was an illegal campaign contribution because it vastly exceeded the amounts you can give to a candidate. So either way, there is real legal jeopardy here, criminal legal jeopardy, not just civil.
On Thursday, President Trump on Twitter, he basically was tweeted about this $130,000 payment, saying that he paid money to this attorney, to Cohen. He was saying that this was something that wealthy people do. Kind of a strange way of, again, seemed to try to spin this.
He is trying to spin it, but there's only so much spin you can do. Money changed hands right before the election on an issue that was very politically sensitive. This wasn't just some rich person, some celebrity randomly trying to protect their reputation. That spin just doesn't work, particularly when Trump originally lied about the payment. Now he's trying to tell a different story. None of his stories are credible since they are based on the crumbling foundation of an initial lie.
Well, in addition, Giuliani spoke about former FBI Director James Comey, and he said that Trump fired Comey because Comey would not, among other things, say he wasn't a target of the investigation. And again, he really sort of waded into more controversy for the president.
He definitely made an already difficult and complex situation for the president worse. This is not, God knows, the 500th justification that we've heard for the firing of Comey, and it just makes less and less credible the claims being made by the president, because it looks like they're just reaching to find something other than the Russia investigation and trying to shut down the Russia investigation as an excuse for the firing. They're trying to throw mud at the wall and see what will stick. And that tactic just doesn't work. This is what happens when your attorney is a loose cannon with an ego big enough to cover an entire ship.
Alan Lichtman is a professor of history at American University. He was speaking with VOA's Sarah Williams.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
The group that hands out Oscars for excellence in movies expelled actor-comedian Bill Cosby and director Roman Polanski because of cases of sexual assault. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences here in the U.S. issued a statement saying its Board of Governors continues to encourage ethical standards that require members to uphold the Academy's values of respect for human dignity. The Academy adopted a new code of standards in December following accusations of sexual harassment and physical abuse by movie producer Harvey Weinstein. It is time now for a look at what's trending on social media. VOA's Doug Bernard joins us. What do you have there, Doug?
Well, today I think we're seeing social media being used for a very important topic. And I say this not just because I happen to be sitting behind a microphone and have been a journalist for many years of my life. Today is World Press Freedom Day. It was first founded back in 1994. And the news is not necessarily so good that reporters, journalists around the world are facing increasing pressures, increasing restrictions, increasing threats to their safety. It's harder and harder to get the story out, in effect. So people are sharing lots of opinions on social media. Let's just take a look through kind of a very quick little survey here. Here's Rebecca Harms to begin. She's an EU parliamentary member. She says, in Turkey right now, 179 journalists are in prison this very day. This is the highest number of jailed journalists in a single country since World Press Freedom Day was established. Turkey, one of the biggest offenders, but I say one of the. Christiana Mampour, a journalist with CNN. I know journalists everywhere will continue to pick up their gear, go out and cover the important stories, even if it means they themselves could become targets. We saw that just last week when sadly we lost three of our colleagues in Afghanistan. A number of other journalists were killed in an attack there in Kabul as well. Here's Al Jazeera World. The fight for the release of an Al Jazeera journalist continues. Mahmoud Hussein has been imprisoned in Egypt for over 500 days. Andrew R.C. Marshall, who is a Reuters correspondent. Here's what World Press Freedom Day means to our jailed Reuters colleague Wallon, speaking in handcuffs, flanked by police on the steps of the courthouse where the farcical trial against him continues. And there's a clip there as well. This final quote I will leave with you. This is from Keith Pochick, who has this. These are not his words. Here's the quote. "The only security of all is in a free press. The force of public opinion cannot be resisted when permitted freely to be expressed. The agitation it produces must be submitted to. It is necessary to keep the waters pure." That a quote from Thomas Jefferson, who famously had a number of run-ins with the press and political opponents as well, but clearly never forgot the importance of a free press in the functioning of a democracy.
And many thanks to you, Doug. That is VOA's Doug Bernard. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Fish farming will produce about two-thirds of the world's fish food supply by 2030, and that means there will also be a lot of fish waste. But in Ciudad Valles, Mexico, tilapia fish farmers are expanding into the fish skin business. Fish farmer Juan Castillo says the goal is to harness the waste of the thriving industry of fish farming. He says our main priority is to produce more fish meat at a lower price, and by tanning tilapia skin, we produce things like money bags, shoes, and different articles. Scraping and tanning and painting and stretching, not very sophisticated, but Castillo says it means more money. This is an alternative for extra income, he says, that we can see as an added value over something we never did before. It might be a niche product, but the exotic fish skin is unique, and fishermen are hopeful that designers will find more ways to use it. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. Now a little something from the world of music. the coming together of three Jamaican-born superstars of jazz. Pianist Monty Alexander, drummer Sly Dunbar, and guitarist Robbie Shakespeare. Their collaboration, Monty Meets Sly and Robbie, was a big hit and acclaimed by both critics and fans. Monty Alexander started playing the piano when he was 4 years old and has a talent for translating tunes to the keyboards. His recording career has covered many of the well-known jazz standards, pop hits, and Jamaican songs. Alexander has lived in New York City for many years and performs frequently throughout the world at jazz festivals and clubs. Always on his playlist is Mercy, 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 originally written for Cannonball Adderley, and has been performed by many, including the Buckinghams and Queen Latifah. Sly Dunbar and Robbie Shakespeare are prolific rhythm artists who first teamed up in the 1970s. Dunbar began playing at 15 in a band called the Yardbrooms. Among his greatest influences was the drummer for Booker T and the MGs, Al Jackson Jr. In addition to his many years of collaboration with Sly Dunbar, Shakespeare is highly respected for being an influential reggae bassist and his creative use of electronics and production effects. Hot Milk was a big hit for Alexander, Dunbar, and Shakespeare, and always tops their fans' favorites. I kind of came late to Jamaican jazz, but I really like it. Heard about it when I was in Jamaica once, and Ran into Monty Alexander in New York at a club. Since then, I've been big fans of those guys. Hey, listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you here. The latest world news is coming up shortly, and hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman. We're all here in Washington hoping you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from Monty, Sly, and Robbie.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the identification or location of Maulana Fazlullah. Further, the Rewards for Justice program is offering $3 million each for information on Abdul Wali and Mangal Bagh. All three men are associated with the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan Terrorist Group, or TTP. The TTP opposes the Pakistani military, and among its stated goals is the expulsion of coalition troops from Afghanistan. The group has demonstrated a close alliance with al-Qaeda. Maulana Fazlullah is TTP's leader. Under his leadership, the TTP has claimed responsibility for the December 16, 2014 attack on a school in Peshawar, Pakistan, which resulted in the deaths of 148 people, including 132 students. Fazlullah also is responsible for the June 2012 beheading of 17 Pakistani soldiers, as well as the October 9, 2012 shooting of Pakistani schoolgirl Malala Yousafzai. The U.S. State Department tagged Fazlullah as a specially designated global terrorist in 2015. Abdul Wali leads Jamaat al-Ahrar, a militant group affiliated with TTP. Under Wali's leadership, this terrorist group has staged a number of attacks in Pakistan, targeting civilians, religious minorities, military personnel, and law enforcement. Mangal Bagh is the leader of the Lashkar-e-Islam, another terrorist organization affiliated with TTP. Under his leadership, Lashkar-e-Islam operatives have attacked NATO convoys. The group finances itself through drug trafficking, smuggling, kidnapping, and fee extortion on transit trade between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $145 million to more than 90 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. For more information about Fazlullah, Wali, and Bagh, go to www.rewardsforjustice.net. We encourage anyone with information about these men to contact the Rewards for Justice office via email, info@rewardsforjustice.net, by phone 1-800-877-3927 in North America, or by mail, Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.